Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Race and Means. This is Tuesday, February 15th, and we're beginning to hear the budget bill for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And this is a public hearing that we're opening. And Mr. Siebert, do you have anything to say to set the stage?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe the director is here to go over his presentation briefly. I've passed out a copy of the PowerPoint presentation. You should be able to find that at your places.
Okay, and I will call forward Mr. Byler, the acting director, and any people that you wish to bring with you, and kind of scabble over to Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. One update is I'm no longer the acting director. Confirmed last week and now on board for my four-year term. So very pleased to be with the agency.
Let the record reflect
that
it's too late for
us. And for the record.
Does that go for us, too?
For the record, Tom Byler, executive director of the Oregon Watershed Board. Appreciate the opportunity to be here before the committee today to walk you through the agency overview and discussion of the key topics relating to the agency's priorities, program priorities, performance measures, and the reduction option that we've laid out for you in the materials that you've received on our budget. Without further ado, I think I'd like to just move into our presentation. And I want to, we have a number of slides here, and I want to move through it with a fairly good pace, and I'll rely on committee members to let me know if I'm moving along too quickly or if they want me to focus on specific points. I'll be happy to do that.
They may have some questions as we go, so I might have to get my hand up until Representative Kropp gets here.
Very good. So this is our phase one presentation. And we will be talking about, we've organized this presentation into four chapters that relate to the budget book that you have in front of you: agency overview, the prioritization of programs, our performance measures, and reduction options for reductions. OEB's mission, quite simply, is to help create and maintain healthy watersheds and natural resource habitats that support thriving communities and strong economies. You're going to see through the course of this presentation that we try to balance those three elements of the economy, communities, and the environment in the decisions that and investments that OEB makes. What does OEB do? At its core function is a grant program. We invest in local communities to improve water quality, fish and wildlife populations, and watershed functions for healthy watersheds. The key principles that guide those investments and that I feel very strongly about and am interested in helping the agency move forward on are to make sure that our investments are strategic in nature, that we're figuring out where the best investments can be made and for what types of purposes, that we are tracking the effectiveness of our investments so that we have some sense that the different types of projects, we have a sense of the value for those projects and get a sense of the return on investment for those types of projects that we do, and that we're making progress under our investments through the Oregon Plan, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. And last but not least, that we want to make sure that these investments, that they're fiscally accountable, that we're getting, a good return on investment both from not only effectiveness standpoint in terms of the projects are actually doing some good on the ground, but that we're getting the most for our money. OEB's importance to Oregonians. Three areas that I want to stress with you today. One is that the investments that OEB makes through the grant program enhance the quality of life for Oregonians. These investments improve water quality, fish and wildlife, and watershed functions, and essentially make the place where folks live a better place to live. And we know that's businesses look at that when they're looking for places to locate. They look for things like the quality of life and the nature of the watersheds and how healthy and clean the water is in those areas. So we contribute to that. We also build local partnerships by investing in these local groups that I'll discuss in a little bit more detail we invest in local entities, watershed councils, soil and water conservation districts, that really do the on-the-ground work of figuring out what needs to be done in terms of watershed health and figuring out how to do it. Those partnerships, those groups, represent a variety of different interests among the community. And so it's a great forum for building a sense of partnership within these local communities, and we empower them to control their own destiny and to take care of their own watersheds. And lastly, OEB's importance to Oregonians is involved with our supporting both near-term and long-term economic benefits through these watershed investments. And I'll talk about that in a little more detail later, but we do, through our grant investments, provide support for jobs, supplies and equipment, and many, the vast majority of these dollars are spent locally. And the long-term investments are further out on the radar screen for us, but ultimately we're looking at opportunities to rebuild and recover species so that we can remove restrictions, for example, like the Federal Endangered Species Act, and rebuild sustainable fish populations, for example, that that would provide an opportunity for sustainable commercial fisheries. A little bit about the nuts and bolts about OEB. The board is a 17-member policy oversight and decision-making board. It represents diverse natural resources backgrounds. Of that 17-member board, 11 are voting members. They consist of 5 members of the public at large, 1 tribal representative, and 5 members of the Natural Resource Agency boards and commissions. Those are the commissions for the Environmental Quality Commission, the Agriculture Board, the Fish and Wildlife Commission, the Water Resources Commission, and the Board of Forestry. Thank you very much. And we also have non-voting members that represent federal agencies as well as the OSU Extension. The real value, in my view, of the way that the OEB board is set up is that we provide a forum for these natural resource management experts, policy experts, that represent these different disciplines. They're sitting at the table together making decisions about how to make these investments of the OEB funds. So it's kind of the OEB serves a bit as the melting pot for the natural resources management in that arena. OEB staff, our agency, we have in this current biennium 23.3 FTE. We have field staff that represent 5 regions across the state, and you'll notice in your materials, a couple of these staff have extremely large areas to cover. And these regional staff are really important. They are our liaisons with the local districts and councils and the private landowners who benefit from the investments that we make through our grant program. They do a lot of the hand-holding with these folks. They give them a lot of advice. They help them work through the grant application process. They attend a lot of meetings. They go to a lot of these local meetings in the evenings. These folks are on the road a lot, and they have a very hard job, and they do quite a good job given the big workload that they face. The rest of our staff are located in the Salem office. We handle the broad grant management responsibilities, monitoring and reporting program, policy, and fiscal control issues. Brief overview of some history of OEB. In 1987, the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board was created and operated for somewhat similar purposes to OEB today, to invest in watershed health-related projects. At that time, the GWEB, as it was called, had a bit more of a modest nest egg in terms of funds to distribute, but nevertheless, the purposes were largely the same, and they really focused on what served as demonstration projects of what could be done out in the field and with working with private landowners. In 1997, the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds was created by legislation. This signaled a watershed moment in natural resources management for the state. This program the Oregon plan is unique, and it really is unique in terms of natural resources management in the nation. I'll talk a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of it, but it is a plan that relies heavily on volunteer local participation, grassroots efforts for its effectiveness and for its real power. And OWIP plays a significant role in that, but I'll discuss in a minute. 1998, ballot measure 66 was passed. This dedicated by the Constitution 15% of lottery proceeds, lottery revenues, to be split 50% to a parks fund and 50% to a restoration and protection fund. And I'll walk you through that in a minute as well. But this is one of the key sources of revenue for the Oregon plan for purposes of Measure 66, as well as one of the key sources of revenue for OWEB. In 1999, the legislature created OWEB to replace GWEB as an independent state agency to administer the Measure 66 funds. The Constitution requires that a single agency administer those Measure 66 funds, and in that session, OWEB was designated as that agency. And then lastly, in 2001, this rounds out the responsibilities for OWEB by housing the monitoring, information, and reporting areas with OWEB as part of the Oregon Plan. Now, as I mentioned, the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds is really, again, a unique and innovative natural resources management approach where the state is intending to control its own destiny, essentially, with respect to recovery of species and focusing on water quality in a way that really empowers local communities to be a big part of the solution. There are four key elements to the Oregon Plan. One is enhancing coordinated efforts between agencies. So these agencies are talking together much more, coordinating their actions. Prior to the Oregon Plan, you had a situation in the state where you had a fairly balkanized collection of natural resources agencies, each with their important mission. Since the Oregon Plan, you still have those agencies, but they're talking to each other a lot more and coordinating their actions in a much better way. The second leg here is the local voluntary watershed restoration. That's highlighted in bold here because that is a major function for OWEB. We are the key state agency responsible for delivering the resources for those local voluntary watershed restoration efforts. The third leg is monitoring and reporting, and again, that is in boldface because that is another area that OWEB plays a principal role in coordinating Oregon Plan functions on behalf of the state. And lastly, we have the science oversight. This is the independent multidisciplinary science team, IMST, that provides a peer review and independent science review and feedback loop for the state in terms of the status of the science and the biology, and help provide us some guidance in terms of our priorities and the direction of our focusing our resources. I want to spend a minute on the source of funds. Again, ballot measure 66, just as a reminder, was passed in 1998. 7.5% of the revenues are dedicated to the salmon restoration, watershed health, water quality, again, to be administered by one agency. We also, though, have federal funds that come to the state through the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund. These funds must be used for protecting and restoring salmon and steelhead species subject to the provisions of the Federal Endangered Species Act. These funds are appropriated annually. They are distributed to five states and Pacific Northwest tribes. And the lion's share of, historically at least, the lion's share of the funds have been going to Alaska and the state of Washington. But Oregon averages somewhere in, we've ranged in appropriations from about $9 million to $17 million annually, probably a rough average would be maybe $10 to $12 million. The next flow chart here describes the flow of the ballot measure 66 revenues. And here, again, out of the 15% that was designated from ballot measure 66, it's housed in the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, which is then split into two funds. One is on the right-hand side, towards the middle of the page, you see the parks subaccount. I'm not going to talk about that. That's the State Parks Department fund. But on the left-hand side, you see OWEB and 7.5% for restoration and protection subaccount. Those are the dollars that from these lottery funds for ballot measure 66 that are targeted for watershed health, water quality, and habitat restoration purposes. The Constitution further divides that subaccount, the OWEB subaccount here, into two classes of funds. On the far left, towards the bottom, you'll see 65% goes to the Watershed Improvement Grant Fund. These are often referred to as capital dollars or capital expenditures. These dollars are available for on-the-ground or intended for on-the-ground projects and the activities that are directly related to those on-the-ground projects. It could be for equipment, supplies, the labor involved with putting those projects on the ground. On the right-hand side, where you see the 35%, these are non-capital dollars and essentially are intended for operations support. These dollars can be available for education, outreach, capacity for local groups, as well as monitoring and technical assistance.
Just a clarification, are these two percentages in the Constitution?
Chair Krieger, Senator Shields, yes, the 65% split expressly is laid out for the 65% for the grant or for the capital expenditures.
Representative Dinkfelder, Jim.
Well, I just have a follow-up to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just can't remember, Tom, are the definitions spelled out in the ballot measure, or is that for rulemaking or for capital versus non-capital, or do you have a list? Was it through AG's opinion? I'm trying to remember how we determine that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, they're not expressly laid out in the Constitution, as I understand it, but they have been an ongoing series of definitions, I think, over time as people have worked with the grant program and tried to figure out what's the appropriate use of the funds. Ken Beerley may be able to get some historical clarification of this.
Could you use more than 65% if you found that you didn't need the 35?
Correct.
But not the other way around.
Correct. The response to the question, for the record, Ken Beerley, Deputy Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, Chair Krieger, Representative Dingfelder, the House Bill 3225 that was passed in 1999 has an explicit definition of capital that is being interpreted by the Attorney General's office to define just exactly what that means. But there was significant discussion by this legislative body in 1999 to define what capital and what non-capital were. So that was the formative definition of those pieces was at that point in time, and it was a legislative decision.
So another follow-up. So in other words, the 65 and 35 is in the Constitution, but all the definition has been legislatively derived.
Correct. That's correct.
Just a couple more points, and I'll move on from this slide. There is another fund in the middle between the capital expenditures and the non-capital expenditures that's derived on the interest of those two funds. It's for Restoration and Protection Research Fund. It's a fairly modest fund. I think we have in the governor's recommended budget there is an unallocated line item for about $1 million of that revenue. And as at the bottom there, obviously, the legislature makes the final decision about where those funds go and in what amount. This next flowchart charts the process for the revenue from federal funds, the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds. As I mentioned earlier, these are annual congressional appropriations So every year we have to go back and see what we can get from that fund opportunity. Again, it goes to the five Pacific Northwest states and Pacific Northwest tribes. It is and can be subject to congressional earmarks. For example, this year, for fiscal year 2005 federal dollars, $1 million of the Oregon Fund has been earmarked for fish marking trailers. And we have very little that can work to our benefit or work to our detriment, depending on the nature of the earmark. Once the congressional appropriation is made, OWEB makes a request to the legislature to apply for for a grant from the federal government to receive the dollars. We then, OWEB then, if the permission is granted by the legislature, we then apply to NOAA Fisheries for our share of those federal funds. Assuming grant is awarded, we then come back to the legislature and ask for expenditure limitation. And if the legislature decides they can't appropriate those funds, and then they are available to OWEB, the board, for distribution through its grant program. This next slide gives you kind of a very high-level picture of our revenue and governor's recommended budget. And I won't spend a whole lot of time on it, but this is kind of the big picture. On the left-hand side in the pie chart, you'll see the total revenues available. And I just wanted to point out the different sources, that some of which we've covered and some we haven't. You'll see that there are Measure 66 capital and operations funds there. You'll also see the Measure 66 research and development fund, which is, again, a small sliver of the pie there. You also see the federal funds, the PCSRF, the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund. There are other funds as well, a very small slice there on the right-hand side of that pie. Those are, I believe, from the salmon license plates, those funds. And then the last piece, committed carried forward, $10.9 million. These are funds that were appropriated to OWEB previously, have been awarded to grantees, but have yet to be expended by the agency because the grants that were awarded sometimes takes several years to complete. And so there's this ongoing process as we manage these active grants to mete out the dollars on an as-needed basis, depending on what stage they're at with their projects. So we'll be looking for expenditure limitation to be able to make sure that we can continue to fund the completion of those projects. On the right-hand side, you'll see the governor's recommended budget, the same ending balance as in the pie chart. Under the governor's recommended budget, $73 million would go through OWEB for its expenditure budget. $10.3 million of those dollars are federal dollars that would be allocated to other agencies to support purposes consistent with the Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Fund. Under the governor's recommended budget, $25 million of Measure 66 operations and capital funds would be distributed to other state agencies to support functions consistent with the purposes of Measure 66. And then there is, through the governor's initiative for line game revenue, at this point, unallocated $9 million that we would expect through the forecast of line game revenue. This, of course, would be subject to the 65-35 split that we talked about for capital and non-capital dollars. So it would be roughly about $5.85 million of capital funds and about $3.15 million in non-capital. Also within our budget is an ending balance of $1 million that's unallocated in operations funds. And then, as I mentioned earlier, an ending balance of $1 million for Measure 66 research and development funds that hasn't been allocated.
$25 million transfers to other agencies. What's all included in that? Where is that money going?
Chair Krieger, those funds are supporting what have some of the similar types of fund shifts that have occurred in the past to support other natural resource agency efforts. I'll give you a general list, but please don't hold me to the detail on this. There is funding support for the Department of Environmental Quality relating to their TMDL work. There is funding for the Department of Fish and Wildlife for habitat biologists. And I think
get us a list of those and the amounts.
Absolutely.
Please.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me.
Can I request that also for the $10.3 million of the PCSRF funds right in the line above?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Shields.
To excuse the excuse me, but maybe I'm confused. Aren't those allocations already spelled out in House Bill 5074? Or is that something that I'm totally confused about? Because it has all these state police, fish and wildlife, agriculture, DEQ. It has them all in here, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I don't know if it has the numbers, the amounts. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. Yeah, okay. $2.7 million to Fish and Wildlife, $5.8 to State Police for Fish and Wildlife.
And that is a reflection of the governor's recommended budget.
I'm going to address that point.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that Senator Shields is exactly right. And we can get you some more information on where all the dollars went. I can, at the next meeting, I'll make sure to have a handout for you on those specifics and also a little bit more detail on totals and what the totals are for.
Very good. Thank you. Please continue.
If there are no more questions on this slide, I'll move on. How OEB is organized, I won't spend a lot of time on this. This is a fairly busy slide, but the point here is to give you some sense of, I mentioned at the outset that OEB's core function is this grant program, delivering these dollars to local communities for a variety of watershed health-related purposes. Here's our makeup, in very briefly, our grant management section on the far left, the column on the far left. This is our field staff, the folks who focus on the review of grant applications, who manage active grants after they're awarded. A very, very important function for our agency. Also important is our grant fiscal work. These are the folks in our office who track the accounting for these grants, who deal with the payments, and who make sure that we're fiscally accountable for the distribution of these funds. Our monitoring and reporting section coordinates monitoring information with other state agencies. We don't do the monitoring ourselves. These are largely done by other state agencies. We sometimes help with supporting their functions through funding. We're primarily, though, a coordinating function not a duplicative function, but trying to make sure that all of the monitoring that we're doing is targeted in the right area and that we're using that information to make more effective strategic decisions in the future. We also spend our energy on monitoring to monitor the effectiveness of the projects and the investments that we make on the ground through this grant program to better understand the different types of projects that are available and what value they bring, what's the return on the investment. And on the far right, we have agency administration. This is essentially is the director's office, which is the point on policy and legal coordination. We work with the board, coordinate with our board, do intergovernmental coordination, work with the legislature, and public information and citizen outreach functions. OEB's grant program. This slide gives you a quick sense of the variety of types of grants that we offer through our program. The more traditional restoration grants, these are on-the-ground projects or habitat protection investments. We have assessment grants. so that people can understand the status of their watersheds and develop plans to figure out priorities and how to meet the needs, the ecological needs in those areas. We have monitoring grants so that we're tracking what's happening on the ground and understanding, better understanding how our investments are paying off in the long term. Technical assistance grants so that these local entities have the types of expertise they need to make good decisions in terms of projects. Local capacity. These are dollars available for these local groups to help them keep running so that they're staffed and have the resources to put together the grant applications to work with and building partnerships within their local communities. We have a small grant program which offers $100,000, I think, per biennium to 28 different teams of representing different regions across the state. And those teams develop and make decisions on how to distribute those funds for what we call small grants. These are no larger than $10,000. They tend to be restoration specific, but it's an opportunity for us to invest in local communities in a way that really empowers them in a real and tangible way to help get projects on the ground. We also fund riparian efforts under the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program and partner with local landowners and the Department of Agriculture in implementing that program. And we also fund grants for education and outreach relating to watershed health and then, of course, research, as we've mentioned before. This next map here gives you a sense. These restoration projects are, they don't include small grants, but they are kind of our regular restoration types of projects. And what I would point to here is that you see all these dots. These are the locations of the projects that we've done. And you'll note when you look at the map, you'll see the kind of a darker green areas that cover a lot of the state. Those are federal lands. The lighter green or mossy gray type of color is private lands. And you'll note that most of the investments that we make through OEB are going to these private land areas. So we're really meeting a need that wouldn't otherwise be available through these investments. Again, this is just part of the picture. This doesn't represent all the investments we make, but is a good example to show where the OEB dollars hit the ground. In terms of our grant management, all of our grant applications are competitively selected based on criteria established in administrative rules. We have more than 100 reviewers that sit on 5 regional review teams and 2 statewide teams that are included in the review of applications. These reviewers represent a lot of different natural resource expertise and disciplines. To give you an example of the workload that we would receive in terms of grant applications in a biennium, this biennium we had over 785 grant applications come through our door for consideration. These were all reviewed by these regional review teams as part of their workload. In addition, in terms of grant management, we have more than 900 active grants that require continued attention by staff.
Tom? Of the 785 grant applications reviewed in 0305, how many of those are granted?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to check with folks here.
See Ken's scrambling there, so I'm sure he has it for us.
Well, Mr. Chair, one point I would make is that we haven't finished the biennium yet, so there are still 2 grant cycle opportunities in March and May, so we're not quite done yet. We've had all the applications in, but not all the decisions by the board have been made, but we can get you a sense of where we're at right now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
While they're looking up the answer to that, Tom, a question regarding the grants. Who does the reviewing, and are they compensated for that work, or is this a combination of compensated people and volunteers that review grants, or how's that handled?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, a lot of these folks are if you start seeing some people get nervous back there, you'll know that I'm probably not as educated on this point as I need to be. My understanding is that a lot of these folks are state and federal employees, and they think they do that within the scope of their regular employment and are not compensated by OWEB. I'm not clear. There's no one that we pay. OWEB does not fund the review for any of this. So they either are volunteering or it's in the course of their regular scope of duties under whatever salary they benefit from.
I just would like to say if that's the case, that's a shining example of how to do it right. I've discovered that even charitable choice grants from the federal government have compensated reviewers, you know. So things that are supposedly very volunteer end up, you know, being income streams for grant reviewers that make a living on it.
Point well taken, Senator. Thank you. And do you have that other number for me, Tom?
Mr. Chair, to date, we've awarded 400 grants this biennium.
Okay.
And that number will grow before the end of the biennium.
And do you have an average dollar figure of what those grants are? Ken, go ahead. You're just chomping at the bit. For the record, state your
name. For the record, Ken Beerley, Deputy Director. Thank you very much, Chair Crump. The grant applications and awards have ranged from $500 to a little over, I think, $3 million is the largest one. So an average for grants outside those extremes would be something in the neighborhood of $25,000 to
$30,000. Yes, Representative Krueger, and then Representative Schaffer.
I think probably for Ken, I can remember, Ken, at one time we had 238 grant applications. You sent them to my house, and four large toilet paper boxes full of these books bigger than that in there, and there was no way to read through that and remember what was in the first box with all these figures. Did you ever get it down to where there was a summary sheet that the board members could really focus on, and it told them enough that, you know, after it was reviewed, someone gave you the information that they really understood what they were doing? I think part of the time we felt like we're kind of floating, weren't certain.
Chair Krupp, Representative Krueger, the way we present information now is significantly different than we did when we were sending you toilet paper boxes full of paper. What we do now is provide the applications themselves on a CD. We provide a spreadsheet that captures and encapsulates a summary of the information, the dollar value, dollar amount requested, the total dollar of the project, so that you can look on a limited number of sheets of paper on the applications that are in front of the board now, so that at least they have indicated, the board members have indicated that it's more understandable to them at this point in time. But we do understand that we do try to make that bulk of information available to them, because there is detail in each of those applications that people spend a lot of energy to put together that the board members should have access to. Whether they have time to read all of them or not, it's a different question.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. These reviewers, that's a pretty important job. How do you pick them? How do they qualify? And do you spread the projects around evenly around the state? Johnson Creek goes right through my district. I'd like to do projects up and down the creek for a lot of reasons.
Believe it or not, you do more than you know.
Yeah. Oh no, I've toured it. They're doing a great job. But how do you choose these folks? How do you get that job?
For the record,
Chair Krupp, members of the subcommittee, I'm Roger Wood. I'm the OWEB Grant Program Manager. We have five regional review teams that are recruited from the same agencies, same entities that are represented on our board. So long story made short, we explain to those agencies what we need in the way of reviewers in terms of expertise and time to devote. They recommend staff to us, and we agree on someone who will represent that group on the on that particular review team. And it was a second question that I...
Oh, that was just having fun.
They do a lot of work for us. They carry a lot of our water. Again, excuse the pun.
right. Thank you very much.
Funds are okay. We don't fine for funds, by the way.
Maybe we should.
I think they're a fine idea.
Oh, geez. All right. You keep it up, and we will. All right. Thank you very much, both of you, and please continue.
Just a quick, at a glance, the grant application review process, two cycles per year, I believe, a 21-week period from the time the applications are submitted to final board decision. Again, the regional review team is involved in reviewing these. They bring the expertise that we need to help provide recommendations for the board that makes sense. What I want to point out here that's important is that the staff funding recommendations are sent to the board, but there is an opportunity before final decision for applicants to comment on the staff recommendations before the board makes its final decision. So it's a good opportunity for a dialogue and some opportunity for the applicants to make their case.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Let's cut you up a little fuller. Tom, what percentage of grants typically do you fund? I mean, it probably varies every cycle, but Roger's shaking his head. But I mean, you know, just to get a sense of how many requests are out there and how much we're actually able to fund. Do you have a sense of that over the years? So are we seeing variations?
Chair Krieger, Representative Dingfelder, we do see variations from cycle to cycle. However, every cycle we have many more requests than we could fund. Not every application receives a due fund recommendation on its way to the board. I would say that maybe two-thirds of the applications we receive on rough average do get a due fund recommendation, and that we're able to fund 60% of those approximately. And then those that are due fund projects and are below the line, so to speak, in funding often come back to us in the next grant cycle. So we will often get a chance to fund them later.
And just a quick follow-up. Thanks. I was going to ask, do you work with the applicant to help them, you know, if possibly it was a marginal project, to work on, you know, the analysis or getting the information they need to come back to you next time? Or
we do. We write a review that is made public, of course, and it explains what we found strong or weak in an application, and that we hope serves as some guidance to those who fell below the line because they were a lower priority in funding or just did not get a due fund. And yes, we work with applicants as well who call us up and ask us questions about the application, the process, the priorities, and so on.
And one final question. Is there an opportunity for somebody who was not funded to come in front of the board and state their case? Or, I mean, has that ever reversed a decision?
There is an opportunity not only for them to comment in writing, but also to come to the board meeting and testify before the board makes its decision on the grants. And that does, and the board listens to these things, and it has changed the board, the outcome of the board's actions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might just to follow up on Representative Dinkel's question about how many grant applications were submitted and how many were approved, we have in your budget book that we've submitted to you in Section 6.2 a table. We didn't do the math in terms of the ratio, but you'll see a table that lists out the number of applications by biennium. And the number of approved side by side. So if there's no more questions on this, I'll continue on.
Please.
Fiscal accountability, again, is a big part of what we do. Staff review each grant agreement for fiscal and legal requirements. Payments are internally audited. Each payment is internally audited. 10% of every grant award is held by staff until we receive acceptable final report from the grantee that all the accounts, that accounts for the full use of the funds in accordance with the grant agreement. In addition, every restoration project grantee is required to report on the project for 1 to 3 years after the grant is completed. Again, we're just trying to track the effectiveness of this project, of the various projects. Monitoring effectiveness is another key area for the agency. We have worked with other natural resources agencies to develop a strategy that will document the status and trends in aquatic conditions, measure the effectiveness of Oregon Plan actions and programs, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. The most immediate and I think fascinating example of that is the work that the state has done with respect to the coastal coho assessment and project. And then key is to use that data. It's one thing to just collect the data, but the one thing that we need to make sure that we're continually focusing on assessing that data so that we can use it to inform future decisions and make sure that we're making good investments. Reporting results is another responsibility for OWEB, not only in terms of the actions that the OWEB board takes in terms of granting funds, but also with respect to the broader actions of agencies under the Oregon Plan. We produce every biennium a biennial report on the Oregon Plan. We are expecting that to be completed at the end of this month, and we'll make sure that the committee receives copies of that. We also provide information through a Oregon Watershed Restoration Inventory. This is an inventory a database that's unique in the state. It includes all of the relevant information associated with the grants that we award. And those grants that are completed, we require that information to be submitted to us, and we keep it in inventory. We also work closely with our partners in other agencies and federal government to encourage the voluntary sharing of their information as well. The Oregon Plan Information Strategy, we've done a couple of things recently as efforts to pull this information that we've been collecting over the years through the Oregon Plan and through our monitoring efforts and to make it accessible to the public in a way that's meaningful to them. The most recent culmination of that is in a contract that we had with the Institute for Natural Resources at OSU. We recently put online the North Coast Information Portal. This provides a nexus of natural resources data from a variety of sources pulled together in a way that is very user-friendly and informative. Another reporting element that OWEB has relates to the use of our federal funds, and we report, I believe, annually on we do report annually on those expenditures.
Yes, Senator.
That North Coast Information Portal has an address.
Address. Sorry, we didn't include that on this slide. It's if you on Oregon on OWEB's website, there is I believe what's new. There is a jump site that's what's new, and you'll find it housed in there, and that'll link you to that portal.
Okay, thank you.
Continue.
OWEB's partners. As I mentioned earlier, the OWEB board and the folks that we work with on the review teams represent a wide variety of different natural resources management perspectives. Well, our partners also represent not only those interests, but a wide variety of interests, all of them important, ranging from tribes, business and industry, nonprofit conservation groups, private landowners, both from agriculture and forest background, municipalities, counties, watershed councils, and soil and water conservation districts. What I wanted to do very briefly now is to give you some examples of some of the outcomes, some of the results of OWEB investments. This first one is Boxler Creek investment. And on the left, you'll see two culverts side by side. That is what's known as a fish passage problem.
I would say that's about right.
We're not going down. It's an upstream problem.
That's right. It is an upstream problem.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Isn't it wonderful we can all agree on something?
The ones that can make that jump are genetically superior.
And they're hatchery fish.
You got adipose fin missing. They can't make it.
All right, please continue.
Quite simply, what you see here is a before and after. And on the right-hand side is the result of a project that was that OWEB had funding to support. A bridge replaced the culvert road blockage, and within a couple of years, spawning salmon were returning upstream in that area to good habitat. That's on the Oregon coast, by the way, north coast.
Yes, Creek.
Are we still, it's been a while since I've been there, but we found good project there. The whole culvert inventory of the state was done, and that's well on its way. Are we still finding good subsidy projects that really are meaningful out there? Is there a backlog of need of real good projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I think there are a lot of good projects, and what I've heard in my short time at OWEB is that the applicants are getting more and more sophisticated in terms of the applications that they're submitting. So they're really their level of sophistication and understanding of the problems and ways to address them are growing exponentially, which is a interesting problem for the board, because we routinely get more applications than and requests for funds exceed the amount of resources that we have available to fund. We're also, as a state, getting better at figuring out where our priorities lie. And the Oregon Coastal Coho Project is an example, I think a shining example of that, where we have done a very detailed assessment over the last year of the conservation efforts on the Oregon coast that we've done under the Oregon Plan. We've pulled together the monitoring information that we've collected on the coast and have a clearer sense of the biological status of the coho on the coast. But through combining that analysis, we're able to, at a population level, which are fairly discrete geographic units, able to fine-tune our strategic focus on what types of limiting factors or conditions that adversely affect the fish we need to be focusing on and where. And I think that's the future of the Oregon Plan, quite frankly, is that level of analysis so that we can be very strategic and smart in how we invest our dollars. But Ken Beerley's here as well, and he may either correct me or have something to add on this, but can give him a minute, please.
For the record, Ken Beerley, Deputy Director, Chair Krupp, Representative Krieger. I'd like to take a little different tact on that question. For fish passage barriers, the state does not have a complete inventory. We are working closely with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to develop a database that would start to compile that information, but there are very limited areas where there is a complete database or complete information on fish passage barriers. One of the troubles we had in looking at the effects of the work done to date for coho salmon in the North Coast was we knew what we'd done, but we didn't know the universe of problems out there, and we're trying to get that latter part funded. We know where there are barriers in some limited areas where we have funded inventories. For example, the Scappoose Bay drainage, which drains directly to the Lower Willamette, the Columbia system. We funded an inventory of barriers in that drainage. They found more than 170 barriers in that relatively small drainage. The Council, the Soil and Water Conservation District are partnering on removing strategically removing the ones that are most important in that drainage, but we don't have that kind of information uniformly across the state, and that's an investment area that we're working with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to try to remedy. So I hope that helps, and we still get good projects, but we are relying more on the information that's provided about that project rather than the full universe that where that project fits in the watershed in the basin today.
Senator Shields.
Yes, Ken, as you were describing that, 170 in one little Scappoose
drainage area. You know now a lot more than you used to know on the universe. Can you make any prognostications of what you might imagine this universe beginning to look like? I mean, when Representative Krieger asked this question, I all of a sudden thought for a minute, gee, you mean we might actually get it done and run out of projects? And from what you just said, I think it's going to be a while. Can you paint a little more into the picture?
Yes. For the record, Ken Gearley, Deputy Director, Chair Krupp, Senator Shields, there are some places in the landscape where there have been complete inventories. The Forest Service has done a complete inventory of culverts on Forest Service lands, and that's roughly a quarter of the state. And they've found in excess, and this is high in the watershed, they've found in excess of 3,000 barriers in the state of Oregon, I believe. And they've found that 60% of those provide some sort of barrier to fish passage. Most of it's barrier to juvenile movement. Some of them barriers to adults. So as you get lower in the watershed and you get into the developed portions of the watershed, there will be greater numbers. And so problems or areas like the Willamette Basin will have significantly greater density of potential fish passage barriers.
Okay, Senator Nelson?
These barriers all man-made?
For the record, again, Ken Beerley, Chair Krupp, Senator Nelson, the inventory that we're working on is just man-made barriers.
Correct. Okay. Yes, Representative Schaffer.
These surveys, do they have to be done by paid staff, or do you allow, like, Johnson Creek Watershed Council, can they go out and do a survey up and down the creek?
Chair Krupp, Representative Schaffler, we have been doing funding inventories where people went out and did them. We know that there are in the Coos and Coquille watersheds. They've been doing them on their own with some of the council support and volunteer efforts. There's a variety of ways in which these. What we're trying to do is create a database so that people could provide that information and then it could be looked at more holistically instead of finding the right person who knows the right thing.
A question for you. Ken, you might as well stay there for a moment. Now, you do work with other agencies such as Division of State Lands, County Extension Services, and local... See, it's NRCS offices now, for stream stabilization, a whole host of things that have to do with fulfilling the mandate of Measure 66, correct?
Correct.
What percentage of those cooperative, are those grants that are applied for, or do you have separate funding set aside for those types of cooperative arrangements?
Chair Krupp, our program is a grant program. The only set aside for cost share is through the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, where the board allocates a match that is automatically matched with Farm Service Agency funds. The only other allocation of funds that we do is through the small grant program, where roughly $3 million gets decided on by these local small grant teams who then identify projects and work with those. But the statute that created the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board was pretty clear about the board being the entity that allocated money, so we take things to the board for their decision.
Okay, so if you have a, for instance, I have an elderly couple, unfortunately the husband just passed away a couple of weeks ago, that are on a creek, and the creek has been dramatically eroding to the point where their home, the foundation, is within about 5 feet of their foundation. And so what we're trying to do is find a solution for them, working with DSL and also with the NRCS, trying to see what opportunities are there for funding to try to find a way of stabilizing that bank that creates opportunities like this. So in other words, you don't go out and necessarily just riprap the bank, but you look at making combinations of placing wood structures and those types of things to find solutions. Do you have to do those kinds of things on a case-by-case basis? And if so, how long does that take, especially when you have, say, a home that or a structure that has been identified in imminent danger? How do you handle that at the agency?
I'll take a stab, Mr. Chair. There are opportunities. It would take some time, as you saw, if they went through the regular grant proposal process. I guess to preface my remarks, that any funds that would be available from OWEB to help a situation like you described, there'd have to be a real nexus between the activity and improving watershed health. And so that would be part of the analysis that OWEB would have to go through. There could be opportunities to expedite funding through the board on a direct allocation basis. In other words, it wouldn't go through the formal grant process, but they do have the ability to do special funding, direct special funding for purposes. It's not typical. It's not the norm. It's not what the board likes to do on a regular basis,
right,
but it has happened.
But okay, fair enough. All right. Members, any additional questions on this? Yes, Representative Krieger.
Ken, I think you'd remember, isn't there something in the Division of State Lands? They got some emergency rules to protect property. There's something there.
Chair Krupp, Representative Krieger, from the regulatory side of the Division of State Lands, they have there is a provision in the removal fill law that allows for emergency actions. That's separate from the funding. The funding, I believe, is what Chair Krupp was asking about. And we have an application review process typically set up for restoration projects. We are not set up to deal with emergency situations, so we're not a good fit in any emergency situations.
Should you be?
It's a very good question, and the response is the constitutional dedication of these funds for efficient wildlife habitat enhancement defines kind of the parameters, and the question is whether an emergency that relates to life, limb, and property constitutes an effect on fish and wildlife habitat. Where those two can marry up is where there might be opportunities, where there are times when they don't marry up, and making those calls is not easy to do, but it's something that could be looked at.
So, again, the real nexus is that it has to be something that really does improve watershed health. That's the criteria that you're going to look at, whether it's this kind of a project right here or it's anything else that comes down the point. So that is going to be really your major criteria, it sounds like.
That's the filter that has been placed on us. Yes.
Okay.
Chair Krupp, if I might add also, the board is not... it's not really designed, as Ken Beerley said, to focus on emergency situations, nor is it at this time really structured to do so. The board meets the board would have to make these funding decisions, and,
right,
and under its current process, they meet about four times a year. Not very conducive to meeting emergency needs. But certainly, if that would need to change if it were to try to focus on those types of situations.
And later on, Paul, do we have as part of their performance measures something about the length of time for grants and applications to be processed? I forget in our review of that. Do you have a performance measure for that?
There's a performance measure on the turnaround for payments.
For payments.
Yes, not for the process of reviewing applications.
And what is the average length of time for reviewing applications?
21 weeks.
21 weeks. Okay. Very good. All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate you indulging our questions. Please continue.
Just a few more examples of outcomes of OWEB investments. I don't want to spend too much time on this. There's a lot of text here, and I won't go into it in great detail. This is Paisley Town Weir. This is a situation where OWEB has helped fund what we look at as the classic win-win scenario, where we're helping fund a project that would remove a 15-foot high fish passage barrier, retain irrigation for ranchers in the area, and improve the trophy red band fishery in this area by increasing the habitat for that. This is a project that is one of a number of projects by folks in that area showing a real steady, engaged partnership of local, state, and federal folks working together to improve their watershed. We also fund assessments through our grant process. These, again, are essentially studies of the status of the health of the watershed. And here is an example of a very recent draft assessment report from the Upper Williamson River in the Klamath Basin. The important point here is that these are generated locally. They have lots of local involvement. We really depend on the local know-how and experience and the fact that these folks can ground truth what's happening in the field as the basis for building these assessments. These assessments, when done right, really lend themselves to be the strategic plan for future investments and to restore and recover the watersheds in those areas. An example of our monitoring grant funds at work. Here you have a photo of some folks enjoying a little swim in a stream on the mid-coast. They're snorkeling and they're doing a survey of juvenile salmon in that area. And the notion behind this was that this Mid-Coast Watershed Council we funded this monitoring assessment so that they could get a better sense of what are the where the salmon were, where they were going, what is the real key habitat for these salmon, and at the same time we're able to identify fish passage barriers in those areas and provided them the foundation for being able to make more strategic investments and understand where they wanted to focus their priorities. OEB's grant program also funds organizational capacity. Watershed councils are listed here. I want to be clear that these aren't the only local organizations that are funded through the revenues of Major 66 and federal funds. They are, however, a key for OWEB because the statutes directly direct OWEB to help support the capacity of watershed councils. The key point here is that this last biennium we funded 58 watershed councils, partial support for their organizational capacity. That's 58 out of a total of 92. These decisions are made. We now have in place rules that provide a merit-based criteria for distributing funds to these councils, and we're in the process right now. I think May is when the board will decide on the next biennium's awards, and it's based on work plans that we receive from the councils and their track record, essentially.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry. This is preying on my mind. Back to the Klamath Basin slide, you have this field truthing with local knowledge. Now, I've been down there and met some of them folks, and they have pictures of certain times of year, Link River with no water in it. Now there's folks that say they need to take some of that diverted water and put it in there in those times of years, when there is some local knowledge and photographs of there not being water. How do you all, who decides what the local truth is? I guess that's my question. How do you deal with those? I'm opening up a can of worms here, but I just—it's on my mind, and I can't help asking.
That about 2 hours.
How you deal? No, not. I'm not talking about just. I'm not asking you to solve that specific problem. I'm asking you, how do you decide what is the local knowledge and what is the truth?
Mr.
Which
Chair.
Is more than 2 hours. That's two millennia, probably, of philosophy.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, that is a difficult
issue and not one that does present an easy response. The key for OWEB is to have that engagement with the local folks, that we need to get their feedback. We need to know, there are going to be situations where you're going to have a split within the community. That makes things more difficult, no doubt about it. But the key is that we're out there talking to folks and listening. And you do the best you can with the information you have. Hopefully in most situations you won't have big splits or divides within the community. It's not always going to be the case. I think in most cases it probably is. But the key for us is to engage them and listen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
If I may briefly, Ken Berry, Deputy Director, Representative Schaffler, in this specific instance, what we found when they were on field trips and they had fish biologists and foresters and water resource specialists with local people in the Upper Williamson, and they were talking about the Upper Williamson where people lived and worked, they were able to talk about the same things. And they didn't have differences about the facts. What they worked on was how do you figure out then what you want to improve upon, and they could agree upon certain elements they wanted to improve upon. And it's interesting, and that's one of the things that at least I think is very important about this effort, is that it talked about a specific and relatively small piece of geography, if you call 1,000 square miles small, but it's something that they're able to agree upon, which is very different than the Klamath Basin, which is too big for anybody to agree to. And the people in the Upper Williamson felt comfortable with the representation and felt comfortable enough to have their pictures on the front of the document, which is pretty impressive. We've had watershed assessments where the ranch brands became part of the document on the front page with Forest Service and with OWEB. And that to us shows that the conversation is happening locally and people are buying into at least the shared understanding. And then they wrestle locally with what we want to do. And then we invest in those as they meet kind of regional priorities.
Okay, very good. We're going to have to move along, and I'll take Senator Shields' question, but we have 45 minutes left today, and we need to get to Deb Marriott and Nancy Molina before we finish up today. So let's remember to try to move along. Senator Shields.
Mr. Chair, my question isn't a question, it's just a comment. Most people don't know that I spent 3 years living within about 200 yards of the Williamson, the Upper Williamson, as a local pastor down there. There's a lot of people in that conversation, including the Native Americans that are down there. The important thing that they're doing is making sure that they're talking to all of the folks that are a part of the equation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Crump.
Mr. Chair, I will pick up the pace here. Just want to talk about one of the points I made at the beginning is that OWEB's investments are not only about watershed health, not only about building partnerships, but these investments are happening in local communities, and they have economic benefits. We've had a couple of studies looking at the effects of our local investments, and I just wanted to lay out two or three points for you. Each dollar OWEB grants for watershed council support, for example, generates an additional $5 in watershed projects in local communities. Now, the benefit there is that we're in as we invest in capacity for these local groups, it's translated into dollars for projects, and those dollars for projects in turn are translated into dollars in the local community for projects, the labor, the supplies. And as we go to the next point here, 80% of the OWEB grant funds are spent in the county in which the grant is awarded. That's good news locally for folks. It's supporting local businesses and labor and supplies and equipment. And lastly, and by the way, these pieces are included in one of the in an appendix to our budget book that we have. And describe how they came about these in a little more detail than I'm going to provide for you. But lastly, the funding for watershed projects
leverages an additional $1.70, almost $2, in economic benefits to the community. So these investments are not only helping the watershed health, but they're also benefiting communities in which that exist in these watersheds. I've talked about near-term and long-term economic benefits of the investments we're making through OEB as part of the Oregon Plan. Here's one example of some near-term, real near-term investments. In the Coquille watershed, the Watershed Council there decided that it wanted to support a crew that was implementing projects on the ground. And they have, over the last 7 years, been able to support a full-time family wage crew of 7 to 11 people who are doing restoration projects, not only for the council, but the council also coordinates with other federal, state, local partners to farm out this crew for other projects. And they've been able to sustain this for a number of years. This is pretty unique, and it takes a lot of work on behalf of the Watershed Council to make this happen. But it does show that there are some opportunities to be a stimulus for the local economy as well. Long-term benefits are, I think, at hand, and we hope to see unfold as part of the Coastal Coho Project that I mentioned earlier. This is where we've assessed the biological status of coho and the conservation efforts we've taken under the Oregon Plan. This will put us in a position, we hope, to not only inform the federal listing under the Endangered Species Act and possibly remove or give the federal government reason to not list the fish, which would provide some benefits locally since they will no longer have the federal regulations to deal with, which creates some planning issues and less certainty for their actions. But also, we're teeing up this process to develop a conservation plan, a recovery plan, working with the locals in the area and along the coast. And that's where we can develop goals for rebuilding these stocks in a way that will provide some economic benefits in the long term. For example, if the local community decides, in that area decide they want to rebuild stocks so that they far exceed the threshold for the listing, the federal listing, we could find ourselves in a position down the line of building sustainable commercial harvest to a much greater level than we have currently. At this point, we're moving into Chapter 2, and Mr. Chair, I don't know how you want to use the time today, but we can talk about program prioritization, or we can, if you want to have the others come on board.
Why don't we have the others come forward first, and then we can get into prioritization next.
Very good.
So if we could have Deb Marriott. Deb, are you here? Very good. Please come forward.
Mr. Chair, while she's coming up,
yes.
I just wanted to thank Mr. Beiler for... I saw this in Water Committee too, and I think you've added or at least more emphasized on your bullets of your partners of business, industry, wood fiber, agribusiness industries, and I appreciate that because a lot of the folks up in my neighborhood just think everybody in business is bad, and that isn't the case. They're helping out. They care about water quality and fish habitat as well, so thank you for revising that.
Welcome, Devin, for the record. State your name.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the Trust Committee. My name is Deborah Marriott. I am with the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership.
Deb, it is okay for me to call you Deb or Deborah.
That's fine.
Is Deb all right? Would you move that microphone? You have such a lovely, soft-spoken voice.
Not quite as robust as your voice.
We want to be sure we get it on tape. Thank you.
Thank you. The Estuary Partnership is here this afternoon because since 1995, we have received funds from the State of Oregon and the State of Washington to help support our program implementation. We thank you for the past support, and we look forward to working with you through this session as we set our agenda for implementing our management plan. You've been a very primary factor in the success of our program to date. This year alone, we're restoring just under 3,000 acres of habitat. We're working with 12,000 children and 400 teachers helping replace school programs that are suffering. We launched a water trail for paddlers that also incorporates local retail information. We initiated water quality and habitat monitoring. In the last 4 years, we planted over 7,000 trees with 4,000 volunteers at 9 restoration sites, and we're helping communities and builders reduce their stormwater runoff. The Estuary Partnership is one of 28 programs in the National Estuary Program designated as nationally significant by its acceptance into the program. The national program was established by Congress in 1987 to assist national estuaries that have been degraded by human activity. We are a two-state national estuary program. We work in the tidally influenced waters from Bonneville Dam to the Pacific Ocean. We cover just about 6,000 square miles, 11 counties, 31 municipalities, 38 school districts. We are 238 children, 2 million citizens, and millions of fish, birds, deer, and other wildlife. From 1996 to 1999, we were required as part of the National Estuary Program to develop a management plan. We completed that on time and under budget, and we used a very extensive and innovative citizen and constituent involvement process to identify 43 specific actions that we all agreed would help advance the health of the lower river and estuary. Since 1999, we've been implementing those 43 actions. We now work as a nonprofit organization with a 21-member board of directors with both public and private citizens participating. We have several active work groups, and we now have a staff of 12 full and part-time employees. We do what we do in a collaborative partnership way with many, many existing local entities and organizations. Interest is actually to build and support the local interests and knit them together, if you will, so we're all making more strategic investments about the limited resources that we all have. For example, Tom talked about the assessments that OWEB funds. We often go in after the assessments have done and help support some of the actions in those assessments. And specifically, we've invested a few $100,000 in the Scappoose Watershed Council to help them implement aspects of their watershed assessment. We're also, to your questions about tide gates and culvert inventories, we're working with a number of the watershed councils in our study area and the Columbia River Estuary Study Task Force looking for grant funds to, in fact, fund an inventory of tide gates and culverts. We have three overriding goals and objectives. One is that we protect the ecosystem and species by increasing wetlands and habitat by 16,000 acres by 2010 and promoting improvements to stormwater management. That toxic and conventional pollution is reduced by eliminating toxics and establishing maximum daily loads for streams that do not meet water quality standards and reducing other chemicals and heavy metal discharges. And that information about this river and its ecosystems, its economics, its history, and its culture are available to a range of audiences, including children and citizens of all interests. Your funds specifically have been and continue to be critical for us. In your overall budget, our request, we hope you think, is fairly small. We are asking for and included in the governor's budget at $300,000 for the biennium. But we work those dollars very hard for you, and we're able to give you an immediate return of over 400% on your investment. And that's because the state of Washington matches your commitment dollar for dollar, and we secure just over $1 million in 2 years from EPA through the National Estuary Program. And beyond that immediate return and on your investment, we've also worked very hard to secure grants for project-specific work and have brought you an additional $5 million worth of funds specifically targeting habitat restoration and a little bit for water quality monitoring and an even smaller amount for our education programs. What your monies have brought to Oregonians and to Washingtonians are a couple of very important things, we think. First, we're focused on clean water as part of the United States Environmental Protection Agency. We're also very active in the recovery of the threatened and endangered species. We've helped prepare the subbasin plan for the Power and Conservation Council. We are committed to returning fish so the commercial fishing industry and the recreational fishing industry can revive itself. And through efforts like our water trail, we're focusing on tourism and the retail establishments and celebrating those so local citizens have more access to those through participation on the river and paddling. Your funds specifically have supported work in two communities to help them with stormwater management programs and to support the water trail through both the staff person who manages that and a very large committee of volunteers who have helped us put that together and continue to work on that. The state of Washington money has supported our education program, which has reached now almost 40,000 children and 400 teachers. The good news, bad news part of that story is as funding for public schools has diminished, teachers are turning to organizations like ours to help them provide science-based programs, and all of our programs do meet both the Oregon and Washington benchmarks for science programs. And you've also helped support our volunteer coordinator who has worked with over 4,000 volunteers at nine restoration sites. We've removed 11 acres of invasive species and, as I said earlier, planted over 7,000 trees. In addition to that, through the leveraging, your funds have helped support what I call the executive staff, for lack of a better term, that are focused on expanding those resources, and we're the ones who have brought you the additional $5 million in restoration and monitoring funds. And in addition to that, we've worked with Congress over the last several years to secure a 40% increase to the EPA funds that come to us through the national program and to support a $20 million authorization to the Army Corps of Engineers for habitat restoration pursuant to our management plan and the local watershed councils that we work with. I've given you a number of the projects that we've, a number of our on-the-ground results. We, as I said, support local efforts. All the restoration we do not do ourselves. We do by funding existing entities like Columbia Land Trust, Kapoose Watershed, the Klaskanai Watershed Group. And what we hope we bring to the table is a more strategic approach with these partners and working with the partners. So, again, we're investing our monies a little bit more strategically than we all have been in the past. I think at this point I'll stop and take questions, and I understand that we'll get into the more details of our financial picture and yours as we go through the session, unless you would like to talk about that further now.
Indeed. Deb, thank you. Members, questions for Deb? Well, looks like you got off pretty easy.
Not easy on me. Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you for coming and sharing it with you. And, yes, in phase two we will certainly be diving more into the economic issues that affect your organization. Thank you very much. Keep up the good work. All right, Chair, I'd like to call. Next is Nancy Molina. Nancy, welcome, and come forward. For the record, state your name and share with us your thoughts today.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Molina, and I'm here as co-chair of the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, or IMST for short. And Mr. Beiler asked me to come and just spend a few minutes telling you a little bit about who we are and what we do. I don't have any written material to hand you today, partly because I had a very short amount of time to prepare, and also, as you just mentioned, we will be back for phase two, and we will have volumes of information for you at that time. I also have to say you all were making me a little nervous as I was listening to the amount of detail in your questions, and I hate to apologize at the outset, but I have only been with the IMST for about 6 months. We meet once a month, so that's six meetings. I've been co-chair for 3 weeks. I heard about this meeting last Thursday, and I don't have all these people behind me handing me the answers, so I will do my best.
We will be gentle with you, Nancy, I assure you, and take note of that, Senator
Thank
Shields.
You.
Just kidding.
I'm the gentlest of the gentle.
Yes, yes, indeed. Now, Nancy, tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're on the IMST, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Why don't we start there?
I am by background an ecologist. I'm a federal employee. I spent almost 30 years with the Forest Service working as a field ecologist prior to beginning a stint with the Bureau of Land Management. I just finished an assignment as a branch chief for physical sciences, which means that I was overseeing the water, mining, energy, soils, and other programs related to things that are mostly non-living, although the soil scientists would dispute that. Currently, I'm on a special assignment working on some special projects in anticipation of my retirement at the end of May, so I'm kind of winding down some things at the current time.
Well, very good. So what is it that you're... What are you guys in the IMST doing, and why should we care?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm so glad you asked me that question. I would love to talk to you about that. I'd like to start, if I may, with who we are. We are a team of seven scientists representing a whole realm of different disciplines related to natural resources and resource management. We come from a variety of places. Some of us are from academia, some of us are private consultants, some of us are federal employees or state employees. We are confirmed by in a joint process by the governor, by the president of the Senate, and by the House Speaker, and we serve four-year terms, which are staggered, so we have kind of an ongoing transition of our members. The IMST was established in 1997 with the onset of the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, and the stated purpose of having an IMST was it was felt at the time there was a need to have an impartial body of scientists to advise the state on issues related to the implementation of the Oregon Plan. And I think it was in recognition of the fact that the science issues would be very complex and often controversial, and at times you would just need some group to come and just tell you what the facts are without any kind of spin or special interest or whatever. So that's really our job, is just kind of to lay out the facts. And I have to tell you that our members take that charge of impartiality very seriously, and we spend a lot of time agonizing over, are we crossing the line into the policy arena, or are we staying where we should be, which is just presenting information for consideration by people who make policy and who make decisions. The independent piece of our name, it largely relates to that, to what I just said about impartiality. It also relates to how we function. We do not receive assignments. We independently, through consultation with the various state agencies and legislative committees and the governor's Natural Resources Office, we get a sense of what the science needs are, and we work on various reports or workshops or other kinds of ways of presenting science information. We also do receive requests from the state agencies to review various things. For example, currently we're up to our eyeballs reviewing ODF&W's assessment of the coastal coho viability, which is information that will be submitted to NOAA Fisheries for consideration in their listing process. So we do try very hard, even though we are independent and we choose what we work on, we try very hard to be responsive and relevant to the needs of the state. The science piece of our name reflects what we do. We lay out scientific information to policy and decision makers for their consideration and implementation of the Oregon Plan. We cover a broad range of topics. Some of the things that have been addressed in earlier work by the team have been relating to fish recovery, watershed health, water quality improvements, and so forth. We not only lay out findings, we help identify areas of scientific uncertainty or lack of consensus. Sometimes we're asked to develop and evaluate optional ways of approaching things, so there's a sort of a whole collection of things we do sort of under the umbrella of providing scientific information. as Tom mentioned earlier, we receive funding from a number of different sources as a pass-through from OWEB. And mostly what that money goes for is to support the people who actually do the work of the team, which is our two full-time research assistants. And they have a very small staff. We also have a part-time administrative assistant. And they do the legwork of the literature reviews, of preparing draft documents from our very crude outlines and notes of our conversations and workshops. And, of course, they need computers and office space and all of that. So a large part of our budget goes to just supporting the working of the team. Another big piece of our budget goes to partially compensating those members of the team who are self-employed, and they are entitled to have a small amount of compensation and their travel costs reimbursed. And there are also salary offsets for those members who are state employees. Those of us who are the feds don't see a dime, but that's okay. Currently, what we're focusing on, as I mentioned earlier, we are reviewing the Coastal Coho report prepared by ODF&W to go to NOAA Fisheries. Some of our members are also working on what we call the Urban Report, which is a report intended to provide science to Oregon Plan implementation in those highly populated areas where there are some really unique issues with regard to hydrology and all aspects of watershed health. We also have an Eastern Oregon report underway, which is focused on assessment of factors affecting the abundance and the distribution of anadromous salmonids on the dry side of the state, and also to provide information to support the recovery and restoration efforts that are underway there. That concludes my prepared remarks, and I would be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have, as long as they're not too detailed.
Okay, very good. Members, do we have questions?
We all stand so in awe of the IMS team that we're afraid to answer.
Well, I'm not.
Well, some people aren't easily awed. They're just awed.
They're just awed, yes. Don't try spelling that for us. Okay. Look, I do appreciate the commission, or the IMST's, the team's commitment to a serious look at the science and giving us, and that's the reason you're created, is to help us who are not biologists to know what is the truth out there. And I must say, as an editorial comment, that some past members of the IMST have espoused ideas and concepts that I felt were not based on sound science, but rather on an ideological opinion that they have tried to bring forth in the IMST. And I think that's wholly inappropriate, because that doesn't get me to the truth. Even though I may be have a certain ideological idea about these issues, I want to know the truth, and I'm willing to be persuaded by facts, peer-reviewed scientific fact, and I'll accept that, even though I may not like it. But what I don't want to have is someone ideologically trying to color the overall direction of the IMST. And I think we've had that in the facts. In fact, I can cite you specific examples of that. And I think that it is so important that you retain that integrity as an organization, to give all of us, whether we're from the right or the left in how we look at these issues, or even in the middle of the road, the truth, so that we can make good decisions. Because I think we all want the same thing. It's just we kind of sometimes disagree on how we get there. So I really do appreciate that. And please take that back to the IMST, that I think all of us really appreciate the impartiality that you take very seriously, and we take that seriously too. Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. You know, I kind of got to compare you folks to when I was on city council. When I first got on city council, I didn't know anything about government, even though I studied it in school. But we'd sit in rooms like this, and we'd have hearings on, like, a land use decision to give a grant a building permit to somebody for development. And we'd go through these long, boring, tedious explanations about our codes, our requirements under Metro, state land use, all kinds of stuff. And there would be several hearings. And all this knowledge was in my head. And then I made a decision based on that. And I'm a human being. I'm sure sometimes my bias is going to show through in every decision I make. But in the end, I had all that information in me when I made my decision. And the night of the meeting, the neighbors would come in and say, how can you make this decision the way you're doing it? Why aren't you listening? Well, they weren't in there all those other meetings. And you all are out there in your research and your laboratories and your field tests, and I'm not there. And sometimes I wonder, how in the world could they come to that? And so I imagine it's probably 99% fact, and then we're all about our human bias in. But that's kind of what I compare it to. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a hard-legged laborer. But I don't envy you in your position, because it is difficult for me, a non-scientist, to understand how you come to some of these conclusions sometimes. But I can definitely relate where you're coming from, and good luck to you.
Senator Nelson's next, and then Representative Creek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just noticing work with the EPA and other states. It's come to my attention that the Democratic governor in the state of Washington is now coming up with a management plan for the Columbia River, which he may, I think her objective is to create 9,000 new jobs, use more water out of the Columbia, manage it. From my sense, Oregon is, we're way behind that curve. We're not even talking about it. And a lot of it is that we get kind of get all tied up in the environmental issues and the emotions and stuff like that. But my sense of this whole thing is that if we're going to fund our education budgets, other things, I mean, we're going to have to go back to some of our natural resources and manage the Columbia River. So is your group doing anything? And what sort of direction are you going to be taking in all this?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, we have a process for annually reviewing our work plan. And as new issues arise during the course of the year, it's usually in the fall, September, so we take a look at, you know, what are emerging issues and are there science needs within those emerging issues that we can productively address. So certainly the example that you raise would definitely be something that we would consider as an emerging issue. At the current time, as far as I know, there's no current plan of the IMST to connect with that effort. But certainly it will be identified as an emerging issue in our fall review of our work plan.
Well, yes. I guess to me, the state of Washington is, they're being pretty proactive in this thing. It looks like Oregon is being more reactive. And all of a sudden, we're going to be losing potentially a good source of income or, you know, potential job creations, and at the same time being able to protect the environment and save fish. It seems like we're still got our blindfolds on, I just watching the state of Washington, and I just think they're light years ahead of us.
Very good, Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, as policymakers, we have to take into account the social and economic consequences of science. So when you hear the science team, you're only going to get the science. They don't have to take into consideration the right or wrong of that science. We have to take it in. Now, I spent 6 years on the Board of Forestry, and Dr. Logan Norris, I believe at the time, was there. I was extremely disappointed in some of the things that I heard, because I knew them from my experience in forestry. That is not factual. 3 times I asked them to bring me the information on riparian zones and the peer-reviewed science. Yep, I'll get it. My last meeting at the Board of Forestry, just before I was sworn in, I went back and reminded them that I asked 3 times, and for 2.5 years it never came. It didn't come because it doesn't exist. And I got that confirmed from Mr. Brown, State Forester. So I was very disappointed in what I saw happening. Dr. Paul Adams, I believe, had a piece that was called Science 101 and how you evaluate with criteria whether or not what you're hearing is personal agenda, bias, and that type of thing, and how to evaluate that testimony. I would suggest that all of you read that, because it will help, and I've mentioned it before.
What is that again?
Science 101.
That's the name of Science 101.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, if I could respond to
please.
That. One of the things I was expressing to Tom the other day is, you know, I've spent over 30 years helping at the federal level, helping policymakers and decision makers make hopefully sound decisions based on science. And through that history, I have formed some very specific opinions about what is concrete and what's the difference between information and opinion, and also how to express information so that it's the uncertainties and the nuances of it are expressed, but keeping the opinions out of it. And certainly, someone in the science realm who hasn't had the benefit of being that close to policy processes could make some missteps unintentionally, you know, not maybe through bias, but just through not really having a grasp of how to communicate well between science and policymakers. And, you know, I don't want to second guess anything that happened before I got here because I just don't know. But certainly one of my missions, and I think one of the reasons that my colleagues elected me the co-chair, is I do have some pretty concrete ideas about how we can find that line between opinion, policy, and information, and maybe do a better job of hitting the mark than may have been the case in the past.
So we can make rational decisions that we're going to base policy on. If otherwise, I think it's the confidence breaks down in what we're dealing with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, am I in the queue? I wanted to add on to what Senator Nelson was saying, and I don't know if you guys are going to get into this or not, but the numbers we were using in the Water Committee 2 years ago were Idaho takes 4% of annual flow, Washington takes 2.7% of the annual flow, and the state of Oregon only takes 0.3% of the annual flow of the Columbia River. Now look, the representative is right, we have to balance the environment,
Senator,
with society and education. I said Senator, didn't I? Anyway, we have to society, the environment, and the economic part of this state. That's, we cannot just focus on one or the other. And for us to sit here in this state and let all that revenue and all that money and all those jobs just flow down the river when the states around us are totally taking advantage of it, I'm sorry, we're wrong to let that happen. That's my humble opinion. I ain't got, you know, whatever the science says. I mean, we have the reality of having to educate, medicate, and incarcerate 3.5 million people in this state. Hopefully not incarcerate very many.
But, that's
you
in
know,
your district.
And there's one more thing I want to add. Aggregate may be dead and may not be alive, but we all need it to live. I just wanted to throw that in there, too. Stir the pot a little bit with some of my good friends here. Anyway.
Mr. Chair. I sit on the House Water Committee, Vice Chair of that, and we've been spending a lot of time on the IMST. So I just would encourage my colleagues, if you're interested in really listening to the, we have been dealing with the IMST charter review and had many members of the IMST and looking at some of your past projects for about the past year. And so the committee here, we might want to have, a review of some of the information that has been provided for the Water Committee, because there's a lot of really good policy discussions that have been going on. And we do have, right now, we're reviewing some changes to the charter, as I'm sure you're aware, and we've been working very closely with several members of the IMST. But I just want to, I'm sorry I missed part of your talk, and I've been working with the Oregon Plan for almost 10 years. Not as long as that guy, though. He's been working severely on it forever. But my understanding is the IMST was set up really to look at and provide unbiased information about the Oregon Plan, and I think that's an important, I mean, it's not that the Columbia isn't important, but that was the main goal of the Oregon Plan, as Wayne, Representative Krieger knows, because he used to sit on the OWEB board, correct? And so I think just that might be helpful for the committee, you know, in looking at your budget and where you spend your dollars, and a lot of it this past year has been going to the Coastal Coho assessment, and I know you're in the throes of that right now. So just, if folks are interested, we have a lot of great information, and I suggested to Paul that he might want to provide copies of the enabling legislation and statutes for the committee members, because a lot of things are spelled out in law about what the IMST can and has been asked to do by this body.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, certainly when we come back for Phase 2, we can provide a summary of some of the past products and the contribution that we have tried to make, at least, to the Oregon plan in the past, as well as where we hope to go in the future.
I don't know if we've been asking questions or weighing in with our opinions. I think all of us kind of come with prejudices on one side or another. I suppose if I have a prejudice, it would be that I tend to trust science, and I trust scientists to give me the truth. I trust them to be unbiased and to do that job. I understand you, Representative Krieger, as you say, they bring science to the table, and sometimes maybe questionable science, and we have to weigh social, economic, etc., portions of the equation. By the same token, government and policymakers always need as much credible information as they can get. And I'm going to defend the IMST or anybody else that comes to bring us that very, very precious commodity. Around this building, we have far too much smoke and everything else. We need, well, they used to say just fax, ma'am, you know.
Yes, we hope to be Joe Friday's dream team.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that we'll probably leave off here. We have just a couple housekeeping items. The director will be back tomorrow to go over the prioritized list of programs, the performance measures, and the 10% cut lists. Also at your places, there was a handout that the legislative fiscal officer asked that I give you based on a number of questions yesterday on the cuts list and looking at the 10% reduction lists, and you have at your place a copy of Oregon Law 1999 Chapter 1091, which is the law that requires state agencies to identify 10% reductions to all fund types. You also have on the second page the measure history of that piece of legislation, including the two sponsoring representatives. And on the back, you have a copy of the form that agencies are required to fill out when they present their budget information. So just a little bit of background for you from the legislative fiscal officer. I will make sure, Mr. Chair, that the agenda next time reflects the director's new non-acting state.
Okay. Very good. Non-acting state. Okay. All right. If there's nothing else for the good of the order, thank you all very much. We are adjourned.
We like getting